All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman, and today is another Q&A when we're taking a deeper dive into the Falcons' off-season plans and discussing some of the issues facing this team heading into 2018.
You are locked on Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman, founder of FalcFans.com, one of the longest-running Falcon fan sites on the internet, and also the host of this illustrious podcast. We are back today for another Q&A. You guys sent in a lot of great questions today, or over the last couple of weeks, and I will do my best to answer those questions. As you guys know, regular listeners that you are, I try to keep these Q&As from running too long, and that means I can only be selective with some of the questions I answer. In today's episode, I only selected maybe four or five questions to try to answer on this show, and we'll see how long it takes for me to do that. As you guys are downloading the episode, you know exactly how long it is. Me, at the beginning of these recordings, I have no idea how long they're going to be. But any questions I did not get to, and there were a bunch that you guys sent in, I will post as part of a leftover mailbag on LockedOnFalcons.com later this weekend. And because you guys sent in so many questions, particularly two of you, you guys know who you are, that emailed me a bunch of questions. I probably won't try to fit them all into one leftover mailbag. And so what I might wind up doing, if I get the time to work on it this weekend, is I might try to spread those out over two or three different articles on Locked On Falcons between Saturday and whenever I post that first one, which will probably be Saturday or Sunday, and probably Wednesday or Thursday of next week. So definitely be on the lookout. So if you sent in a question over the last week or so and it is not answered on today's episode, there's a very good chance that I will answer it on a future leftover mailbag on LockedOnFalcons.com. So if you guys aren't checking that site regularly, you certainly will want to do so this week. I am, fair warning, I am getting over, or I'm at the very beginning stages of another cold. I just got over one like a week or so ago. I thought I was going to be good to go, but part of the problem with my day job, in which I work in elementary schools and pre-K environments, is that they are germ factories. And apparently my immune system is not as strong as I thought it was. And basically anytime I go into a school after, you know, not going in one for a week or so, I get sick. So hopefully, you know, I don't know if that's going to, you know, me sniffing and whatnot is going to affect the audio too much, but I'll try to minimize my bodily fluids, the sounds of my bodily fluids as much as possible in this episode. So, enough preamble. Let's get into the show. First question comes from Mike Flores via his girlfriend's Facebook page. I got a question about fullback. I've watched every Falcon snap for the past 5 years, and there was a significant drop-off in play at the position. Though I like Derek Coleman's story, I would like it a lot more on another team. Where do you see the team going with that position if there's anyone we could acquire that could come close to Patrick DeMarco's production? This was a question Mike sent in back in January, and I meant to answer it on a previous Q&A episode. I missed it, so I apologize to Mike. Looking at this offseason slate of fullbacks, Anthony Sherman is probably the only one that's hashtag elite that's comparable to DeMarco. But since he's probably going to be looking for a payday similar to what DeMarco had last year, I don't expect the Falcons to basically do a 180 on that. Presumably, we all assume that the reason why the Falcons decided not to sign Patrick DeMarco, because for some, as I would say, ridiculous reason, they decided that the $4 to $5 million of guaranteed money that Patrick DeMarco was going to make on the open market was too much to pay for a fullback. And I don't expect them to change that decision, even though we all probably sit here and say that that was clearly a mistake. But typically NFL teams do not admit their mistakes that readily. So I don't expect them to, I think they'll go cheaper relatively speaking, than that. So I don't expect him to be in the Sherman market, even though he would be the obvious candidate if you want a comparable DeMarco-type player. Who knows? I think instead you probably would see the Falcons target a player like New Orleans Saints fullback Zach Line. Assuming he makes it to the market, he probably won't, because I'm assuming the Saints will make an effort to really re-sign him. And, you know, I think relative for the bang for his buck, Line is probably the best value you can get in the free agent market. Line is not necessarily on close to the same level as DeMarco, but he is a competent fullback that can get the job done and certainly has the potential and has shown the ability that he would be an upgrade over Coleman. I think after that, you don't have a ton of great options. And, you know, one of the things I was hoping a month or so ago was that with some of the coaching changes, you would have some teams moving to a system with a new offensive coordinator that didn't necessarily require a fullback, and maybe the teams would be willing to shop their guys. I didn't really see an example of that, maybe the closest one being the Bears when they hired Mark Helfrich as their offensive coordinator. He didn't really use a fullback in his offenses during his days at Oregon. However, head coach Matt Nagy used the fullback in his offense in Kansas City, which of course was Anthony Sherman. The Bears' incumbent at that position is Michael Burton, who I know was a guy that certain Falcon fans advocated for when he was released by the Lions last spring as a replacement for DeMarco. But to be honest with you, Burton was pretty awful this past season, so I don't necessarily know if he would be the upgrade over Coleman. Maybe. I mean, he's in the past, he's played better than Coleman has throughout his career, but I don't necessarily know, based off of the last couple of years that Burton has had, whether or not that would be an obvious upgrade, but or at least an obvious upgrade enough to make it worthwhile for the Falcons to trade for him in this case. Now, if the Bears happen to release him, that would be a different conversation. And with all that being said, I don't expect the team to draft a guy. I mean, with all that being said, it's possible that the Falcons could draft a guy. And I think probably the likeliest scenario, if they don't get Sherman or Line, the likeliest scenario to me at least is they probably will re-sign Coleman and then potentially bring in some competition. And again, whether that's via the draft, I don't know. I wrote an article back in 2014 titled "Why NFL Teams Are Dumb to Draft Fullbacks." I don't really think drafting fullbacks is a good idea. I certainly would recommend you guys checking out that article if you want to get a deeper dive on this issue. But basically, the research I had done showed that basically the success rate of drafted fullbacks versus undrafted fullbacks, there wasn't a significant difference enough to merit why you would use that fifth round pick on a guy when you're just as, you know, like the chances of you hitting on an undrafted free agent are just about the same as they are hitting on that fourth or fifth round pick. Now, I haven't paid enough attention to this year's fullback class, draft class, to feel like if there is a guy out there that could be the exception to that rule, because there's always exceptions to these rules, and that's sort of part of the evaluation process when it comes to the draft, is you have to determine, is this guy the same old guy that we could draft in any draft in the fourth round, or is this guy an exception to the rule and thus merits us using that second round pick on him or something like that. I like Jalen Samuels a lot. He's the hybrid tight end, fullback, running back, wide receiver from NC State. I like him as a movable chess piece to play that role rather than a true fullback. But besides him, from the glimpses I've seen of the other players like Dimitri Flowers, to me he's like a poor man's version of that. I think if I was guessing based off of the other sort of quote-unquote draftable fullbacks, and typically there's only like three or four guys in any given draft class, I would bet that the Falcons would be looking at a guy like San Diego State's Nick Bawden more so than a guy like Dimitri Flowers if they were going to go in that direction. Bawden, you know, relative to some of these other guys, I wouldn't be upset if the Falcons drafted him, but I don't necessarily look at him as like, oh yeah, that's a slam dunk. You know, he's going to be a fullback that comes in and immediately comes in and plays at a high level. that I think everybody's hoping for. So we'll find out. But it wouldn't necessarily shock me if the Falcons, if we see Coleman come back and the Falcons basically just play a wait and see game, hoping that some late round pick or some undrafted free agent can unseat him. And if not, then if his play doesn't necessarily step up in a significant way, the Falcons are just hoping that maybe some team winds up cutting a guy in late August, or maybe they can facilitate a trade at that point in time that is more suitable to what they're looking for at the position. Now, speaking of the draft, Locked On NFL Draft spent the last few episodes breaking down every team's top needs in the first round. Host John Ledyard and Trevor Sikkema just did the Falcons on this past Wednesday's episode, so definitely you guys want to go and check that out. But make sure you don't miss any more of their podcast by subscribing to that podcast, so you guys can stay locked on the NFL draft all the way until April. All right, our next question comes from Riley Street, the incomparable Riley Street. What happened to Austin Pastor? We talked quite a bit about him at the beginning of the year, but I forgot about him. I know he was injured early, but I thought the consensus was that he was better than Sambrelo, and yet Sambrelo played when Schrader got hurt. Yes, I think Pastor is better than Sambrelo. I think Sambrelo got the nod because he was healthier and he was practicing. And generally speaking, you know, when you're getting the practice reps, coaches are going to tend to trust you a little bit more when it comes to the possibility of you getting game reps. And I think it sort of snowballs from that point on. Once you start getting the majority of those reps at that point in time, there's not a whole lot of reason, barring injury or you just being an abomination on the field, which, even though I don't think Sambrelo played particularly well, I wouldn't necessarily call him an abomination based off his performance last year. So unless one of those things happens, you're probably not going to change horses in midstream, as they say. I would compare it similar to the Tevin Coleman versus Devontae Freeman battle for the starting running back 2 years ago. Both those guys missed pretty much all of training camp. However, Coleman did come back before, I think, the third or fourth preseason game, while Freeman didn't really come back to and start practicing until the week before the regular season opener against the Eagles. So thus, Coleman got the starting nod over Freeman, even though technically he didn't necessarily earn it in a straight-up competition. And then, of course, Coleman wound up getting hurt in week two of the season. Freeman came back in and, you know, basically outplayed him over those next couple of games and took the job from him. And so, you know, we saw an instance where Sambrelo was out, I think, at the midpoint this year during that Tampa Bay game, that first Tampa Bay game. But I think by that point, him having getting the majority of the reps for over the first eight or so games of the season, at that point sort of had solidified him as their go-to number three guy. You know, had it's, you know, I would compare it to the Freeman Coleman thing. If Tevin Coleman had played the first 6 weeks of the season and played, assuming reasonably well, had he gotten hurt then in week six or seven, and then Freeman took over, the chances are, even if Freeman had played well, the chances are Coleman would have gotten his starting job back. And so I think that's sort of the situation for Pastor. Unfortunately, you know, by the time he was fully healthy, Sambrelo had gotten enough playing time to merit sort of the Falcons going in that direction. As for Pastor coming back, I've mentioned before, I do think there's a reasonable possibility that if the Falcons do bring him back this offseason, then I don't think they necessarily need to sign an offensive draft an offensive tackle to push Sambrelo. While I wouldn't necessarily go as far as to call Sambrelo an abomination as a player, I don't feel comfortable at all with him being, you know, one twisted ankle away from starting games. I think we've seen over the course of his three-year NFL career that that's not a good plan, and I hope the Falcons learn from past mistakes and, you know, not put themselves in a situation where, you know, whether that's signing Pastor, whether that's re-signing Tom Compton, who's a free agent this year, whatever it is, I think they need to bring in some competition. And if that's Pastor, I'm fine with that, because I do think, from based off of how he's played in his NFL career versus how Sambrelo's played in his NFL career, Pastor is an upgrade there. And it, when he's healthy, then I think in a legitimate competition, he should or could win it. All right, our next question comes from Riley Street once more. I noticed that all of our away games next year, other than New Orleans and Tampa Bay, are both outdoors and in cities that get cold. Given that we're a fast track and dome team, should we be worried about this? I know that some competition isn't nearly as good. Some of the competition isn't nearly as good, but the elements do change things. It gets cold up north here. I realize our defense is getting better and we have a pretty good run game, and those are the element teams typically want to have in such games. And so maybe it shouldn't be something we put too much thought into. Thoughts, yeah. I would also throw Charlotte is not necessarily a cold weather city. Like, you know, if you're from the South, you know, what is deemed cold in the South, and I live in North Carolina, I'm born in Virginia, is not deemed as what's cold in the North. I went to school in Pittsburgh. There's a very different disparity on what's cold there. Like, a 40-degree day in Charlotte is cold. It's ice cold in Charlotte, when in Pittsburgh, that is the most mildest of winter days, and people are out in t-shirts and whatnot, in shorts, relative to what it is normally in the wintertime. So I would throw Charlotte in there as not a non-cold weather city as well. But I would say, to answer your question, I think you got most of it right, Riley. It could be an issue. I don't know if it will be. It's probably not nothing. I wouldn't necessarily say it's a non-issue, but we'll have to sort of see how it goes. You know, I think teams, you know, as you say, teams do tend to get a little bit more conservative, rely on their sort of ability to win in the trenches in these cold weather games, as opposed to being this high-flying passing attack. And I do think that does play somewhat into the favor of where the Falcons are strengthening their team. I don't know if they quite reached the level where we can call it the strength of the team quite yet, but they certainly have made significant strides there over the last 3 years compared to where they were over the previous 3 years in the Mike Smith regime. I typically tend to believe that matchups matter a lot more than the environment. And looking at these teams, I don't necessarily know how big a deal matchups were going to be. You know, we're talking about teams like Cleveland, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Washington, and Green Bay. Obviously, you know, Cleveland is not necessarily a great team, but if all of a sudden, you know, you're dealing with a matchup where it's Ty Sambrello having to replace an injured Jake Matthews and he's going up against Miles Garrett, that's going to not be a good thing for the Falcons. And I don't know if, you know, and you throw in, you know, a 30-degree day in December, or a 20-degree day in December in Cleveland, on top of that, that, you know, that's not necessarily an ideal matchup for the Falcons, but I won't necessarily know until we actually get to the game day whether or not that's a situation that's truly problematic for the Falcons, given some of the other strengths of their team versus some of the weaknesses of the Browns. Obviously, Philadelphia's defending champs. We know they've pushed us around in the trenches the last 2 years. I don't expect that to change. And what's troubling about that Philadelphia matchup is they've never had both Jason Peters and Lane Johnson on the field at the same time in those games. Like, Lane Johnson missed the 2016 game and Peters missed the 2017 game. And so, assuming they bring back Peters this year, if they have both of those guys, it's going to be a lot harder for the Falcons to sort of win in the trenches there. Pittsburgh, obviously, not, I wouldn't necessarily say a dominant team in the trenches, but when you're a team like the Falcons and have some of the issues they have against the run, when you're facing a team like that has Le'Veon Bell, that's obviously not a favorable matchup. Washington, when healthy, their offensive line is one of the best in football, pound for pound. Their running game isn't quite where the level it needs to be, so who knows about that matchup. But their defense is coming along nicely, particularly at front seven. Green Bay, we've owned Green Bay the last couple of years, but typically those have been games at home in Atlanta, and you know, Aaron Rodgers is generally much better at home in Lambeau than he is on the road. His passer rating last year at home versus away was 15 points higher in Lambeau than it was on the road. So, you know, that's a different beast if you're dealing with a quote unquote elite Aaron Rodgers on top of, you know, having wintry conditions. That's a problematic issue. So to summarize, like, it could be an issue, but until we actually find out when we're playing these games, you know, if they happen to all be in November or December, I'm not going to be as optimistic as I normally would be if we were playing some of these teams on the road and maybe in September and October. But again, we'll just have to wait and see. It could be an issue. It could not be. Who knows? As you say, defenses do tend to travel well. And, you know, I think particularly if our pass rush can live up to the level that I think most of us hope, want, and believe it can or will, then I think a lot of these issues become far less problematic in terms of the matchups than we can possibly foresee. And we got some more questions, but first, I want to remind you guys that it's been a hectic week in the NBA, given the trade deadline. Now they're on the All-Star break, so I think you guys should definitely check out host Brad Rowland, catch up with all the things Hawks on Locked On Hawks, and or any other NBA shows, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, wherever podcasts can be found, now including Spotify. Steven Adahai asks, I know I'm in the minority, but I love Austin Hooper. Ditto, Steven. He is absolute wrecking ball with the ball in his hands, but even still, to be multiple as I think we need to be, our third tight end has to be a massive offseason. Has to have a massive offseason, and I'm not sure Saubert has it in him. Why not bring in someone else who can make something happen as a route runner? Again, this creates a lot of versatility and unpredictability in heavier personnel sets. Fair observations there, Steven. I guess I'm not quite as ready as other people to give up on Saubert. I want to see where he is this summer because, as I've said many times, you kind of have to give guys a year to sort of settle down because being a rookie in the NFL is very hectic. New city, you know, moving, learning a new offense, having suddenly being the worst player on your team as opposed to the best player on your team, that takes time for people to overcome. And so I do think you can sort of tell where guys are, where they are in their second summer, or where guys have the potential to be based off of where they are in their second summer as opposed to where their first summer is. So I'm not ready to give up on Saubert quite yet. I'm not really against adding a tight end, but I think it has to be the right type of player. And I think this is where too often we trivialize needs as we need this position, but in reality, it's less about the position and more about that we need this type of player. And so, you know, for example, not all offensive tackles, not all safeties are created equal. And so based off of how the Falcons offense was called last year, having a move tight end like a Jalen Samuels, who I mentioned earlier, really isn't a great fit here. Like, I like the idea of Jalen Samuels more so than the actuality of what Jalen Samuels will be in this offense. Because if Sark can't really have a firm grasp on what this team's, on how this team should run their 13 personnel in the same ways that Shanahan did, where it's really equally as effective a passing formation as it is a running formation, then upgrading the third tight end position, in my opinion, is not really going to do anything substantially to your offense. And so the idea that we need to upgrade Saubert without first upgrading the play calling, you know, I think one step has to come before the other, basically what I'm saying. You know, for tight end, I think when you look at how this team uses its tight end, what you really want is an inline player that has a little bit more athleticism than a guy like Toilolo does. And the problem is because college tight ends are basically oversized slot receivers more often than not, you know, even Hooper, you know, that's what Saubert was. And even Hooper in his final year at Stanford probably spent more time being flexed out as a slot than he was as a true inline guy, despite, you know, sort of Stanford being that classic sort of smash mouth power offense that we say is a pro style type of attack. And so the problem is when you take one of these slot receivers and then ask him to be an inline guy, there is typically a very long, relatively steep learning curve. And so the expectation that that guy's going to come in and immediately impact this team right away this year is relatively low. So, you know, if the right guy comes along, and I will remind you guys, I haven't done extensive scouting, so I don't have this, you know, firm grasp of this year's tight end class. I've seen some of the guys. I've seen flashes of them. I haven't been overly impressed with the guys I've seen. But if the right guy comes along, I wouldn't be against drafting that guy or signing that guy, but I think just picking up a tight end for the sake of picking up a tight end just isn't really worthwhile. I think instead the Falcons would be better served going after a position that's more of a priority this year and then just waiting to see where Hooper is at the end of 2018, where Saubert is at the end of 2018, and then, you know, where Toilolo is at the end of 2018, and then moving on from there, you know, and then making the decision that they can punt to me the tight end position until 2019, then necessarily 2018. I don't think, again, I can live with our current trio of tight ends. You know, I have a lot more concerns. You know, most of my concerns at that position basically go away if a certain assistant coach does a better job calling plays. And like, you know, part of it is, I think a lot of people, and you're not saying this, Stephen, but I've heard a lot of people saying it, so I'm just going to lump you into this category because I have nothing better to do than complain about other people's takes. But like, part of it is you hear a lot of people talking about, you know, particularly these Hooper haters, which again, I know you're not one of, Stephen, talking about sort of acting like Jacob Tammy was his world-class tight end. And it's kind of funny to me, because it's not like the Falcons lost this world class, this Pro Bowler in Jacob Tammy. Jacob Tammy, over the course of a year and a half playing for the Falcons, had probably six, maybe seven good games in a Falcons uniform over the course of, what, 24, 25 games? And that's like, I'm not trying to bash Tammy. He was fine, but he was fine mostly because the previous offensive coordinator knew how to maximize his value in the offense and his abilities in the offense as well as the other tight ends in the offense. So, you know, I'll say it again for those of you that haven't heard me in the back, and I'm sure this will be the one of 68 times I say it throughout this offseason, but the Falcons' issues on offense, in my opinion, have nothing to do with the fact or the belief that they don't have good enough players on offense. They can go into next season with the exact same 24, 25 players on offense, and if the play calling is better, you will see demonstrably better results, you know. That's my opinion, personally. Like, the only position that I really feel like the Falcons have subpar personnel is the fullback position. And I think you can, you know, like, I don't think the Falcons need to substantially upgrade their offensive personnel or really focus too much attention on that. Again, if the right players come along that really fit what you're trying to do offensively, I'm not going to sit here and criticize them for drafting those guys. But it is one of those things where it's like, you don't need, like, everybody's like going crazy. Oh, we need to get better in the red zone. It's like, yeah, we need better play calling in the red zone. Oh, we need to be, you know, more multiple and formation diverse. It's like, yeah, that comes down to play calling, not because we don't have talented players that can execute, you know, a diverse and multi-formational offense. So I think really the Falcons need on offense, throughout their offense, besides maybe the fullback position, and again, you can tweak depth here and there. But again, I don't think tight end is really one of those positions where you need depth. It's more that you want better depth there. I think in reality, the only need on the Falcons offense besides fullback is they need better play calling. They need an offensive coordinator that has a better grasp of the system. And again, that's not to say that Sark is never going to get it. I don't know what Sark is going to be. I'm cautiously optimistic that he will be improved this year. How much that improvement is, who knows? We'll have to wait and see. But that, to me, is the biggest need that that's the biggest question mark on the Falcons' offense, not as many people term it to be other positions. So to me, honestly, with six or seven picks this year, if all six or seven of those picks are defensive picks, you wouldn't hear me complaining about that. I'd be like, that's actually pretty smart of the Falcons if they did that, you know, and then devote, you know, 2019's draft to upgrading those offensive positions once they have a better idea of what actually Sark is and what his offense is going to be, as opposed to we're sort of in this nebulous territory between, like, we kind of want to do what the Shanahan offense is, but we don't know if Sark can really execute that. And so, like, do we build towards what the Shanahan ideal is, or do we build towards what this sort of unformed version of the Sark offense that we don't really know, that doesn't really exist. You know, people talk about, oh, we just need, Sark needs to run his offense as opposed to trying to run Sanders. Like, but as I've said many times, Sark doesn't really have an offense, because when you look at his time in college calling plays, he ran like 3 to 4 different variations of a similar offense and never really developed, this is my offense and this is what I'm good at. It's just kind of like, I just sort of adjust on the fly and figure things out as I go, and, you know, I add to the things I did before, and I completely, you know, the offense he ran at USC versus the offense he ran his first couple of years with Jake Locker at Washington is different from the offense he ran when Keith Price was a quarterback at Washington, which is different than the offense he ran when he was coaching, who was it, Matt Barkley at USC, and versus the offense he ran at Alabama, and now the offense, you know, there's similarities between these offenses, don't get me wrong, but it's not as if they're the same offense, you know, so that's where I, when people say, like, oh, we just need to, Sark needs to run his offense, like, that offense doesn't exist in the way that you think it does, in my opinion, but we'll have to see. Okay, last question. Hi, Aaron, I have a question about the possible, draft selection for the Falcons, and I'm interested to see what is your take. Now, I know we need help at the, on the D-line and O-line, as well as linebacker, cornerback, etc., but what if we go in a different direction? We are almost certain to lose Gabriel to free agency. And what if we draft wide receiver Christian Kirk? He can immediately take his spot as well as Andre Roberts' place. I think he would be an upgrade at both positions, especially on punt and kickoff return specialists. He's bigger than Gabriel, but just as quick and fast. Plus, Sanu is almost 30, and I don't think he'll play more than 2 years if that. Kirk could be in 2 years or possibly sooner, take his position as well. But some analysts, Kirk is a top five prospect. Top five wide receiver prospect, I'm assuming he's referring to, not overall. And by some, he's a late first or early second round pick, so he could be there for the taking if we want him. I know you don't like taking a wide receiver early in the draft, but Kirk is a versatile player who could immediately help, but in the long term too. What is your take on this? This comes from Zamir Sabanovic. He asked this question on Facebook. Yeah, I'll just reiterate sort of what I said earlier, what I've said multiple times. I don't think the Falcons need to draft a wide receiver early in this draft. I think a big part of that is fueled by my belief that Justin Hardy is one of the more underrated players currently on this roster, and that if he's given more opportunities to get on the field, particularly as a slot receiver, that he could be more than a capable number three. And so the panic that some have in losing Gabriel, I don't quite share. I think for Hardy in particular, the problem he has is that him and Sanu basically fill the same niche on the roster, and that they're primarily slot receivers. And we saw in the second half of 2015 flashes of Hardy's potential in that regard, but with the signing of Sanu, that basically went out the window. And part of the reason why I wasn't and still am not as huge a fan of the Sanu signing as everybody else seems to be, or most other people seem to be, is due to my belief that Hardy could have filled that role as a slot receiver. And the Falcons, in my opinion, basically overpaid for a more quote-unquote proven version of the player that they already had. And that's why at the time I was a big advocate of a player like Travis Benjamin, because his role in the offense would have been substantially different than what we already had on this team. And that's why I also applauded the Aldrick Robinson signing, because Robinson was that sort of vertical threat that we were missing in this offense. And then when we added Gabriel before the start of the season, we added another version of that same type of player. And so I think those were the things that really pushed this offense forward more so in 2016 than the addition of Sanu. I think Marvin Hall has the potential to be that type of player. I think he doesn't get enough credit for people because, you know, of one drop, which tends to happen. As we know, we see that with the Hooper situation where, you know, in that case, it's not one drop, but it's a couple of drops, and all of a sudden it completely shifts the narrative on a player. And this is, again, why I think drops, this is part of the reason why I say things like drops are overrated, because people tend to make, you know, a handful of drops into a much bigger deal than what they actually are. But I think Marvin Hall has a lot of the same skills that Taylor Gabriel and Aldrick Robinson had, and just needs more time and opportunities to develop that. And I think we saw him being used as that vertical threat in the same way that Aldrick Robinson was in the offense in 2016. And so, you know, it goes back to what I was saying just a few moments ago, in that I think if a certain offensive assistant coach does a better job with the players he currently has, a lot of these issues sort of go away, particularly at the wide receiver position. And I don't think the Falcons' need at that position is really substantial. And it's more just of let's add some depth and let's develop some future guys, just because, as what you said, Julio and Sanu aren't necessarily, you know, young guys anymore. And you also have the issue that Hardy's an impending free agent. So you do definitely want to add another piece there at that position that you can have as an insurance policy in case you're move on from Hardy, in case Hall doesn't make that leap, in case you decide to move on from Sanu in the very near future. You want to definitely have somebody already in-house that sort of can grow into that role potentially. But I don't think that necessarily requires the Falcons using the early round pick. And I think part of that is because drafting a wide receiver early doesn't really fit the identity of this team. And it's, you know, this team doesn't use three wide receiver sets. And so I sort of disagree with you that Christian Kirk would come in right away and be that number three that would replace Taylor Gabriel. Only a handful of wide receivers really ever come in and play the amount of workload that Taylor Gabriel had. And most of those guys are first round picks, or they're wide receivers that go to teams that deal with injuries, and obvious for obvious reasons, they get thrust into the lineup, or they're teams with bad wide receiver cores that basically a rookie, even given how limited his skill set is, and rookie receivers are notorious for having a relatively slow adjustment to the NFL because they don't read coverages in colleges like you have to do in the NFL in order to be a guy that can get open consistently. Unless you have a bad wide receiver core, typically only then is a rookie going to carve out a significant amount of reps because you don't have better options, you know? And like a lot of this speaks to draft value, which is something that I'm sure we're going to talk quite a bit about later this spring when we get closer to the draft. So I don't want to necessarily go too deep in that. But it is one of those things where it's like, because of how relatively little the Falcons use what three wide receiver sets, and it amounts to about 55% of the snaps or so, which is like, you know, close to the bottom in the NFL, you know, you don't necessarily need a high level number three wide receiver, you know? And I think what we saw Marvin Hall do this past year against Miami is kind of what you're looking for that third or fourth receiver to kind of do, which is, you know, Hall played 12 snaps in that game, and one of them was a 40-yard touchdown on a shot play. And you don't need him to do that every week. Like, when you go back to 2016 and look at what both Gabriel and Robinson did in that regard, combined, based off the Pro Football Focus numbers, they only caught 60 passes combined throughout the entire 2016 season, and four of those went for touchdowns. And so you don't need Hall to do that every week. You just need him to do that, you know, half a dozen times over the course of a season, which I think he's more than capable of doing if given the opportunity. And, you know, Matt Ryan actually starts hitting his deep passes again. And so, like, again, I don't think that requires you to have a high level, use a first round pick on a number one or number two receiver. You know, and I think a lot of the reason why I think that is, in general, I have a philosophy that wide receivers are one of the most overdrafted positions in the NFL draft. And also, I think because of the presence of a guy like Julio Jones, you don't necessarily need to have premium players at that wide receiver position. I'll explain. Now, I know some of you are thinking, well, what happens if Julio gets hurt? You need to have another guy at that wide receiver position that can sort of, you know, help things out. But the reality is this, guys, you're not going to replace Julio Jones. He's a unicorn, you know? Like, you're not going to find another unicorn, right? You know, the best thing you can do is get a horse and throw some glitter on it, and that's about the best case scenario you can do for that. The reality is, if the Falcons miss Julio Jones for an extended period of time, what are they going to do? They're going to rely on the running game. And so it makes more sense that your replacement for Julio Jones is, let's give Devontae Freeman 25 touches. Let's give Tevin Coleman, you know, 15 touches on top of that. Let's run the football 40 times because, you know, the reality is, particularly a rookie receiver like a Christian Kirk, who, you know, I think is a good player, but I don't, you know, I know some people see him as this Odell Beckham-esque player. I don't quite see that based off what I've seen. But, you know, again, I think expecting him to be that sort of unicorn type of player, I think is probably being overly optimistic. But who knows? Maybe he is. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I was wrong about Odell Beckham because I didn't think he was that guy, but I don't know. Just like, to me, like, wide receivers are one of these positions, like, to me, they're like the last piece of the puzzle. Because so many things have to go right for a wide receiver to be have an impact on the play. You know, the offensive line has to hold up, the quarterback has to make the throw, the wide receiver has to make the catch, and then finally, the wide receiver becomes a part of the play. But if suddenly Jake Matthews gets hurt for 12 games and Ty Sambrello has to start 12 games, all of a sudden, every single wide receiver in this Falcons offense becomes less effective, right? Because Matt Ryan's going to be under a lot more pressure. He's going to get sacked a lot more. The ball's going to have to come out quicker, right? We're going to have to use our tight ends to chip a lot more. And you know, it's so much has to happen for a wide receiver. And I think this is part of the reason, right? And I can't think of the website right now, but there was this website that used to call wide receivers hood ornaments. And I agree with them. They are basically the hood ornaments. And I think far too often teams treat them like they're the engine of the car, they're the transmission, they're the radiator, they're the all the sorts of things that make the car actually go, when in reality, they're the tinted windows, they're the rims, they're the hood ornaments that make the car look good, but aren't necessarily functional aspects of the offense to really make it go. And again, I'm not trying to sit here and be like, you don't need wide receivers to have a functional offense. That's ridiculous. But what I'm saying is I think teams tend to treat them as if they're, you know, where I would say the quarterback, the offensive line, the defense, you know, are more those aspects, and the wide receivers are no more essential than running backs or tight ends. But it's weird to me that wide receivers are typically treated as like these premium positions over running backs and tight ends, where like, no, you don't use first round picks on running backs. And nobody draft, you know, there's been like, what, four tight ends over the last 7 years that drafted in the first round or something like that. And three of them were like last year. Yet, you know, teams will wait until the third round or whatever to take a running back or tight end. But if, oh, we need a wide receiver, we got to get him in the first round. And so this is part of the reason why I think wide receivers are overdrafted. You look at a player like Sanu, and I'm rambling a little bit here, so I apologize. But you look at a player like Sanu, and what was Sanu? He was a third-round pick, right? He was a slot receiver, a backup wide receiver in Cincinnati. And, you know, I don't agree with this statement, but I know there are plenty of Falcon fans that do. And you look at Sanu, and we took a backup slot receiver, put him in this offense, and turned him into what many Falcon fans believe is one of the best number two wide receivers in the league. And is that because Mohamed Sanu was secretly this multi-talented wide receiver that the Cincinnati Bengals misused, and the Falcons just gave him an opportunity that he always deserved? No. The reason why Mohamed Sanu, if he is that is because of the opportunity, because of Julio Jones. And so you don't need to invest in this dynamic number two wide receiver because you have Julio Jones. And hopefully Julio Jones winds up playing another 5 years in Atlanta. And so the Falcons needing to get this dynamic number two guy makes little to no sense, in my opinion. You know, you look at a guy like, you look at, you know, what do you want? If you want a slot receiver, then you can take a guy in the third or fourth round, like Hardy was, like Sanu was, like Cooper Kupp, right? If you want, you know, a vertical threat, you can take that guy. That those guys are on day three of the draft every year, right? Aljack Robinson, right, was a fifth round pick. Stephon Diggs, Travis Benjamin, Kenny Stills, J.J. Nelson, Martavis Bryant, all day three picks, all four fifth-round picks, right? Not to mention guys like Taylor Gabriel, Robbie Anderson, Keelan Cole, Brandon Coleman, Tyrell Williams, Alan Hearns, Myles Austin. These are all undrafted players. Like these, you know, Victor Cruz you might even throw in there as well, even though he was more of a slot receiver, but he certainly had speed to burn. All these, like, there isn't this shortage of fast receivers. Like, that's never going to happen. You know, of all the positions where we talk about, oh, quarterback is a position where you don't have as much talent to meet the demand. Offensive line, you don't have as much talent to meet the demand. Pass rush, cornerback, you don't have these true premium positions, you don't have as much talent to meet the demand for those positions. But wide receiver is not one of those positions. And that's one of the reasons why I compare it to a position like running back, where running back, you have this overabundance of talent at the position, and wide receiver, I think you have the same thing. The difference is that you don't have number one receivers, right? You don't have 32 number one receivers. You have like 8 to 12 of those guys, similar to quarterbacks. But as we've shown throughout NFL history, you don't need a Julio Jones. You don't need a Mike Evans. You don't need a DeAndre Hopkins to have an effective passing game, right? And so it's one of those things where I think teams tend to overvalue these wide receivers because they're always looking, oh, we want to get that Odell Beckham. We want to get that Julio Jones. We want to get that Amari Cooper. We want to get that DeAndre Hopkins. And yeah, if you're looking for that guy, then by all means, use a top 50 pick. Use a number one pick on that guy. But those guys are much rarer than teams think. And when you go back over the last couple of drafts, particularly with all the first round receivers, there haven't been that many of those guys drafted. Right? It's been like Cooper and maybe one or two other guys, and that's about it, even though there's been like 15 number one picks used on wide receivers. You know, the Devontae Parkers, the Kevin Whites, just to name a couple of guys that immediately jump off the top of my head, where it's like teams are hoping that they're getting these dynamic number ones, but in reality, they're getting like mid-level players. And I think for what the Falcons need at that position, which is a vertical threat, which is an Aldrick Robinson, if all you need is an Aldrick Robinson, why are you going to invest a first or second round pick in a guy for Christian Kirk when you can wait till round four or five, or even get a guy that's undrafted like a Reggie Davis, like a Marvin Hall, you know, like a Taylor Gabriel? You got Robinson off the street, guys. He was on the practice squad of the Ravens the previous year. These guys, you can find these guys off the street. You can go out and get Philly Brown right now. You can go out and sign Kalen Clay in free agency this year. Like, you can get these guys that can be these occasional vertical threats that can fill this, you know, Robinson-Gabriel type of role. It doesn't require significant investment, in my opinion. And so, you know, I think when you're looking at this Falcons team in particular, like, we're a team defensively, we're a team that relies on getting pressure with four guys. We don't blitz very often. So you need your four guys to get pressure. So there's a premium on pass rushers, right? We play a lot of man coverage in the back end, and there's a premium on quality man corners, which typically require first and second round picks. Typically, guys drafted after that tend to be only, in air quotes, nickel guys. You can be good nickel guys, but only nickel guys. And so, like, in my opinion, it makes way more sense to put the premium on those spots where you know you need high level players, right? Right? Where if you want to get a right guard that's an upgrade over Wes Schweitzer, historically you could wait until the middle rounds and get a Josh Sitton in the fourth round. But in today's NFL, because there's so little talent at the offensive line position, if you wait to the third or fourth round to get your guard, chances are you're going to get a lesser player. And so if you want to get a high-level guard, then you need to use that top 50 pick on because of the talent disparity. There isn't a talent disparity at wide receiver position. And so to me, it's much smarter for the Falcons to use a premium pick on a premium position within their scheme, and that is not wide receiver. And that's one of the reasons why I don't think using a high pick on a wide receiver is worthwhile. Now, that all being said, that rant over, if the Falcons did decide to use one of their first day or first 2 day picks on a wide receiver, what that would signal to me is they basically have already made the decision that they are 100% going to cut Mohamed Sanu in 2018. And they're probably, they may or may not re-sign Justin Hardy, but even if they do re-sign Justin Hardy, it will be as a backup. And so if they did that and then made that decision to draft a wide receiver high, then that's basically what it's telling me. If they don't do that, if they basically draft a wide receiver high just to be a backup that plays 300 snaps this year and then maybe 500 snaps next year, that to me is a waste of a pick. Because I can get a nickel quarterback that's going to play 700 snaps this year or next year, and I'm going to need him to play that 700 snaps because we play so much man coverage. I don't need a high-level number three receiver. We had Aldrick Robinson for half of 2016. We had Taylor Gabriel for the other half of 2016. We had Justin Hardy mixed in there as well. We don't need high-level complementary receivers. We don't need a dynamic number two. We don't need a dynamic number three. We just need guys that can, you know, we just need to build a basketball team. We already have LeBron James. Right, we don't necessarily need to go out there and get basketball is not a great analogy, but we don't need to go out there and get, you know, Russell Westbrook to throw on a team with LeBron James because they're gonna not mesh, right? You know, like LeBron James is a point forward. We just need I'm not going to say Eric Snow, but we just need players that you can complement around LeBron James, as opposed to building a team of let's try to get as many LeBron Jameses as possible. Obviously, in a basketball team, that would be ideal, but in a football team where you have, you know, basically 49 other spots to fill on your roster as opposed to 11, you can't afford to sink that many resources into that position, particularly when we rely so much on the run. We play so little three wide receiver sets. We're more of a defensive, physical football team. And the problem is, again, I guess I've gone on this 20-minute rant about this, but to summarize, like, where do the Falcons lose? Do they lose because they don't have enough, quote-unquote, finesse explosiveness players? No. When the Falcons lose games, it's because they get pushed around, right? When we go back throughout the Falcons' history, outside of a handful of games like that Packers game in 2010, almost every major loss that the Falcons suffer is because another team goes out and punches them in the mouth and the Falcons wilt, right? We saw it against the Eagles. You know, I wouldn't necessarily say that the Patriots pushed us around, but they, you know, they got 5 sacks against us in that Super Bowl. The 49ers game a couple of years ago, you go back to all of last year's losses where we got pushed around in the trenches, et cetera, et cetera. Wide receivers don't help that. You know, like, you're not going to become a more physical team because you drafted a wide receiver. You're going to become more of a finesse team. And I would argue that was part of the downfall of the Mike Smith regime, is they went out and spent all their resources on wide receiver. Not to say that the Julio Jones trade was a bad trade, but what it did was it made them into more of a finesse team. And so therefore they became more vulnerable to those physical football teams that were going to punch them in the face and push them around, punch them in the mouth and play that physical style of football. And they were never able to go back to what they were trying to be earlier in their tenure. And I think for what Dan Quinn is trying to build, we need to focus on being physical. And so, you know, if you're going to draft a tight end, it better be a guy that can block. If you're going to draft a fullback, get a guy that can lead block. Get an offensive lineman if you want to. Get a defensive lineman, right? You know, you get a cornerback so that you can upgrade the quality of the coverage so that you can blitz more and be more aggressive and be more physical and throw more 5- and 6-man pressures at teams in order to compensate for the fact that you don't have a front four that can get pressure with just 4 guys. You know what I'm saying? So that to me is where the Falcons need to be focused on. And it's not to say don't draft a wide receiver. I'm all 100% for drafting a wide receiver. For the longtime listeners, they know that I directly attribute the downfall of the 2013 team to the fact that they didn't draft wide receivers primarily for the previous 5 years. Had they been regularly investing in that position, they probably would not have fallen as far, and maybe Mike Smith would still be the coach of the team. So I'm not against drafting wide receivers, but I'm thinking if all you need is just a guy that can stretch the field, if all you need is just basically Marvin Hall to be Marvin, what he was in that Miami game for 4 or 5 games, why use a first-round pick on that? That doesn't require a first-round pick, you know? So that's kind of where I'm at, and I just think it's a complete misinterpretation, a miscalculation of where this team's weaknesses are. This team loses because they get out-physical. Not because they don't have enough finesse explosiveness on their team. They have plenty of that. And again, we would see that come back if a certain assistant coach did his job better. So that's that, guys. Sorry for the rant at the end that sort of meandered all over the place, but I'm sure we'll be talking about it later. But if you wanted to get your questions in or on the next mailbag, or again, any questions I did not get to, we will answer on Locked On Falcons over the next week or so. But you can still submit your questions for those upcoming episodes, and we will, you know, put them in the bank and address them. We'll probably do another Q&A next week again. So any, you know, there may be lingering questions from this week that I don't get to until then. But how do you submit your questions? Of course, you can use Twitter. I'm at FalcFans. If it's podcast related, just let me know in the tweet. But if it is podcast related, just might as well send it to Locked On Falcons. That is the show's Twitter handle. If you don't like Twitter character limits, you can use Facebook. Locked On Falcons is the Facebook page. LockedOnFalcons@mail.com is the email address. You can also leave a comment on LockedOnFalcons.com or FalcFans.com, the two sites where the show is posted daily. We will be back probably on Monday again. The Falcons sort of finalize their coaching staff. We'll talk about that. Catch you guys up on the news. I know I said that we would do these end of the week roundups, but because this was a Q&A, we decided not to do that. And so if you guys, we're going to do fan talks this off season. You can of course email me with your contact information, your availability at LockedOnFalcons@mail.com. If you want to sign up for a fan talk, if you did one during the regular season, I'm more than open to having it back on during the off season as well. So certainly get those in. And in the meantime, you guys stay locked on. I hope you enjoyed it.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Cody Kessler was the USC quarterback. Barkley was before, so.